recently, our company softball team lost the big game by one run. Then Dale tried to console us with the quote, "Winning isn't everything." Dale's a loser. I play to win, like early payout from Bet365. If my team goes up big, I get paid out instantly, even if they blow the lead later.
Sound familiar, Dale?
Bet365. Winning is everything. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-MY-RESET. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
D-Mace, Vingen and Donick, 102.5 The Game. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingen here with you. Let's go to our phone line, driven by Wilson County, Hyundai.com, and welcome in our friend Trevor Maddich, who is brought to you by Houston Clinic Orthopedics, when experience matters. Trevor, we were just talking about Jeremiah Love, and it has been pointed out that no top 10 running back in the past decade has played in a Super Bowl with the team that drafted him. Saquon Barkley went to the Super Bowl with Philadelphia, not New York. Christian McCaffrey went to the Super Bowl with San Francisco, not Carolina. Leonard Fournette went to the Super Bowl with Tampa Bay, not Jacksonville. Why do you think that is, and should it influence the Titans' decision at number four?
I don't think it should. I think that's because the teams they went to, anybody that drafts that high, is not a very good team. And the question is, are they able to build a good enough team to eventually get to the Super Bowl before you lose a player like that, or before you need to trade a player like that in order to stock up from other positions? And so, you know, I think you can probably make the same kind of case where, you know, Drew Brees went to the Super Bowl with the Saints, but he was drafted, I think, by the Chargers. Brett Favre went to the Super Bowl with the Chargers and is quarterbacks now, and he was drafted, I think, by the Falcons. And so, you know, you can point that to a lot of positions. To me, it's more about the rest of the team that's being built around the running back than the idea that a running back at that level is not worthy of being drafted there if you want to get to the Super Bowl. And the thing about this particular guy, Jeremiah Love, is I don't see him really as a running back as so much as a versatile attack piece to move all across the formation, sideline to sideline. You know, I guys like Chestnut and other guys, bigger guys, I think they would use pounding inside a lot more than they would use Jeremiah Love, although he can run inside, certainly, and he would need to, so they can't defenses can't typecast him as just an outside guy and a receiver. But he will immediately be one of the best receivers on this team at any position, whether it's wide receiver, tight end, or running back. And so I can see him not just a really good running back, I see him as a game-breaking playmaker. Now, you guys are talking about Kenneth Walker, the Super Bowl MVP with the Seattle Seahawks, and he went off to free agency and changed teams. But, you know, he kept them in that game early before the quarterback started to pick up the pace, Sam Darnold, in the second half. But he can catch, Kenneth Walker, but he's not considered an elite receiver. He's not a guy that defenses have to game plan for as a receiver. And yet he was Super Bowl MVP. And so I think a guy like Jeremiah Love can do pretty much everything that Kenneth Walker can do and then add a whole nother dimension when it comes to just pure take it to the house speed and versatility as a receiver, not just out of the backfield, but out wide as well. So I think he would be worth it at number four if they decide to do that.
Trevor, your ESPN colleague Dan Orlovsky said on Get Up yesterday that he thinks Ty Simpson is the best quarterback in this draft class and not the presumptive number one overall pick, Fernando Mendoza. Does Orlovsky have a point? And where do you think Simpson winds up in the draft?
I think he's got a good chance one way or another to end up with the Cardinals. I mean, they're needing to reset at quarterback and get their quarterback of the future in the house so they can get him developed. I think Orlovsky makes a great point. When you watch Ty Simpson with Alabama early in the season, you know, exclude the Florida State game. Everybody was terrible in that game. They lost that in the opener. But then the first part of the season, he was incredible. I mean, he was throwing dimes. He was reading defenses at a really fast clip after the snap. I mean, he was doing everything you would want a high first-round quarterback to do. But then later in the season, he fell off. And it wasn't just that the team around him started to degrade a little bit. It was in part because he was missing throws. And that, to me, is a little bit disturbing. Now, when you look at Mendoza ran an offense in Indiana that was simplified in a lot of ways. But from a mental standpoint, he was able to process everything that they threw at him mentally. Physically, he could do everything that an NFL quarterback needs to do. But the difference is that he has a lot of years as a starter experience, going back to when he was at Cal, the starting quarterback in Berkeley. And when you look at Ty Simpson, this is his only year as a starter, 2025. And that is his becoming a red flag, you know, one of the red flags right now is on the Titans roster. Mitchell Trubisky was a one-year starter at North Carolina, did a lot of really good things, had a couple of head-scratching moments, but people thought that's enough. We've seen enough. And next thing you know, in the NFL, he wasn't able to translate the good things consistently enough to be a consistent starter. And so I think you're taking a bit of a risk when you're taking a quarterback that's a one-year starter because your body of work isn't all that high. Orlovsky, though, I will say this about him. He is impeccably prepared. He does not say things for shock effect. In my experience listening to him, he is incredibly thoughtful in processing the information that he gathers and then formulating his opinion. So if he thinks that, I think people need to take a second look at it. It's just that right now, I don't know that I can get on board with that.
We'll talk with Trevor Maddich, ESPN analyst for both college football and the NFL. Now, we assume that, you know, Fernando will be taken first. From the standpoint of the guys after that, these Ohio State guys, Reese, Stiles, Downs, and obviously Carnell Tate, it seems like 1 week one guy is at that fourth pick, the next week another guy is at that fourth pick. Do you see the potential of multiple trades within the top 10? If so, explain why. If not, then you can explain that too.
I think it's possible because I don't know that there are more than about 12 guys that are really, truly first-round grade guys in this draft. So, you know, there'll be 32 guys taken in the first round. But from a standpoint of scouts and general managers, I think you start to run out of elite talent after about the top 10 or 12. And you're getting into guys that are solid. Now, there are a lot of really solid guys in this draft going into the third round, maybe even the fourth, guys where, you know, I think years down the road, we'll see them as starters in this league, even though they weren't taken in the first two rounds. But from an elite standpoint, I think if you want that elite guy, you've got to trade up into the top 10. It's likely not to be a quarterback, although we'll see what happens with Ty Simpson, and we'll see if somebody wants to jump up and grab him. But at the same time, if you want a guy like a Sonny Styles or a Caleb Downs, you're going to have to go get him because once you get a little farther down into the first round, the second half of the first round, you'll have good, solid players, but not a guy like a Sonny Styles or an Arville Reese who are game wreckers. And there's a difference. If you need a game wrecker or a playmaker in this draft that's elite, you've got to get it up into the top 10 because beyond that, you're looking at guys that are merely solid.
Now, when you have that, Trevor, because this process is an ever-changing process, we understand that. But when you're done with the in your experience covering the draft and talking with GMs and coaches, when you get past that point of, okay, they've had their pro days, you brought them in for interviews, you did the medicals and everything, how much truly change with the team in regards to who they're going to draft?
I don't think it changes a whole lot. I think it generally changes for the negative because I think scouts and GMs can get dazzled by workout warriors at the combine and at pro days. They can get absolutely just blown away by some guy who runs faster and jumps higher than they ever thought that he could. And they let that overshadow what they see or what they don't see on tape. And there's an example last year. There was an edge rusher, Shamar Stewart, I think it was, out of Texas A&M, who was just, when you look at him, he looks like the most amazing all-pro that ever lived when he walks off the bus. His numbers in terms of strength and explosiveness and speed and first step, all those things are great, but he only had like 2.5 sacks last year with Texas A&M, or 2 years ago whenever he came out. I think he went to Cincinnati, and there were all kinds of issues there, and he just wasn't productive. But if you look at the guy and look at his times, he looks amazing. But now you watch football production, and it wasn't there. So we'll see if he's able to make that happen in the NFL in ways that he couldn't do it his final year at Texas A&M. I think because of that, to your point, Derek, that scouts and GMs tend to make a mistake by putting too much stock into what they see on pro days and numbers at the combine. They're more likely to do that than they are to look at a guy and say, oh, gee, he's better than I thought he was, having watched him on tape. Because when you see him on tape, ultimately, the question is, can the guy play football? You know, and then as long as he checks other boxes in certain ranges, in other words, you don't want a wide receiver that runs a 4.7. That's why Xavier Restrepo, you know, didn't make it with the Titans, you know. But as long as they check those boxes within a range, then I think that, you know, the most important thing that people evaluating college players coming into a draft is to make sure that they can actually play the game and then worry about some of the other bedazzling things.
So you think sometimes these GMs sort of, because of they're enamored with the measurables, that they go outside of their model they have for that particular position because he may have jumped 43 or he may have ran faster than what that position called for him to run?
Yeah, and I think a really good example here is Jerry Rice, right? Mm-hmm. Jerry Rice ran a 4.6 at the combine, I believe, 4.6. And so he fell to like 21 or 23 to the 49ers. But on the field, he got 100% of his speed onto the field. A lot of guys that run a 4.3, they don't run 4.3 in full pads and cleats. And Jerry Rice did get all of his speed on the field, and you didn't see people catch Jerry Rice from behind very often. Well, look this year at Ohio State receiver Carnell Tate, who is generally thought of as the best receiver in this draft. His combine 40 time was 4.53. 4.53, that is not an electrically fast wide receiver. But at Ohio State, people didn't keep up with him on defense. At Ohio State, he kept getting open deep down the field. Very much like Jerry Rice, his play speed was faster than his 40 time. And so he probably will be the first wide receiver taken, even though there's 20 guys that ran faster 40 times, some of them much faster than Carnell Tate. So the idea is, look at the tape. Can the guy play football? Then look for an exclusionary factor. And we see that in the example that we've talked about over time, and you guys have done a great job with this. And Adam came up with great numbers on this with Reuben Bain, the edge rusher out of Miami. On tape, the guy is phenomenal, but the short arms makes it a red flag. Now you look at some things where they don't check the box, and if they're too far outside of it, that's interesting. It's like Diego Pavia, quarterback for Vanderbilt. You know, he's really undersized for the NFL. He's got everything else, but way undersized. I think, what was his official height? Was it like 5'9", something like that?
Yeah, it was short of 5'10".
Yes, it was.
Yeah, it wasn't tall. And so, anyway, these are things that can be deal breakers, but ultimately it's about can you play the game, and Carnell Tate's a great example of that.
I think there was a 7/8 in the inches somewhere, Adam. You might be able to find Diego's thing because he was like, I swear I had another quarter inch or whatever it was.
Yes.
But Trevor Maddox is with us. Trevor, that, you know, the Ohio State thing has me wanting to ask you another philosophical question, like you were just talking about with the combine, when guys wow you at the combine. When you play for a stacked team like Ohio State's last couple of teams, or the Joe Burrow LSU teams, some of the Nick Saban Alabama teams, just oozing with all these NFL guys, how tough is that on a scout to separate a player that's standing next to two other NFL guys to try to evaluate him as a prospect?
Yeah, Willie, that's a great point. Because you can see a guy have tremendous production in college that is skewed because of the guys around him. And, you know, a guy, a place like Ohio State, for example, has had multiple first-round draft choices in their wide receiver room every year for the last, I don't know how many years, just a long time. And so you've got defensive backs that play way off of those guys because they don't want to get beat deep. And if you're on a team with Marvin Harrison Jr., who's now with the Cardinals, or a guy like Jeremiah Smith, who's still at Ohio State, and he'll come out next year's draft most likely. Now you're Carnell Tate, right? You're not getting the best corner. The other guy's getting the best corner. And the guy covering you is all worried about you burning him deep, and he's playing way off of you. So you're catching all these slants with 5 yards of space, and off you go to the races yards after the catch. And a scout needs to look at things like that and try to extrapolate that into the NFL, where you're not going to have that five-yard cushion. You're going to run that slant, and as soon as you catch the ball, it's going to be contested, and someone's going to be right on you. And to get yards after the catch, you're going to have to defeat that guy who's right on you when you're making the catch. And they'll have to figure out if that guy's skills can translate to the NFL, because in college, he had a lot of extra space because of the team he was on drawing away the best defenders from him. So that's a very good point, Willie, and I think that's something scouts need to pay attention to.
Trevor Mathich has been our guest on DMA's Vingan and Donick. He joins us every Tuesday and is brought to you by Houston Clinic Orthopedics, when experience matters. Trevor, great stuff as always. We'll catch up next week.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks, guys.
615-737-1025. We'll take your reaction. We will also react to what Trevor had to say. Coming up next, Barry Trotz joining us at the top of the hour. 615-737-1025. We are broadcasting from the Busy Bee Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning Game Nashville Studios, home of the $99 yearly Beehive membership, where the buzz is always about great service.